就是中国。
Darum China, der China-Podcast aus Thüringen.
I welcome Peter Draper and Nisha McDonagh for our China Co-op podcast today. Let me please introduce our guests. Peter Draper is professor of economics and director of the Institute of International Trade at the University of Adelaide. He has been working in a range of professions. So he started his career in academia, went to government, joined a think tank, founded a successful company, and has been back to academia since 2018. He also holds a honorary doctorate at our university. Welcome, Peter. The second guest today is Nisha McDonagh. Nisha is senior lecturer at Aideen Cohen University in Perth. Before that, he was lecturer at the International Institute of International Trade in Adelaide, where we also met. He studied in Ireland and Auckland and has been working in the Irish Defence Forces as well as in private business. Welcome, Nisha.
Thank you, Andreas.
Our topic today is economic coercion as practiced by the Chinese government against those trading partners that contradict or criticize Chinese policies. Since we have two Australians here, we would like to focus on Australia. Australia criticized the Chinese government for the information policies in the aftermath of the outbreak of COVID, which then caused the Chinese government to react. Nisha, may I ask you, can we see a direct link between Australian officials criticizing the Chinese government and economic coercion by the Chinese government? And a second question related to this, did the Chinese government communicate this to Australia or to the public?
Yes, so Andreas, there's a very clear pattern in how economic coercion is communicated by Chinese officials. And it's not just in the Australian case, you can see this comparatively too. But let me begin with the Australian case. The trigger for economic coercion was the Australian federal government's call for an independent inquiry into the coronavirus. But this had come after a long period of tensions building up, particularly Australia was the first country to ban Huawei 5G. And as the key American ally in the region is often part of communications criticizing Beijing's actions in the South China Seas over territorial disputes. So there was a buildup of tensions. And essentially, after the coronavirus call, the Chinese ambassador to Australia quite quickly denounced the call in an interview in a major publication, the Australian Financial Review. First, he said the inquiry was dangerous, right? Because it was going to prevent cooperation on coronavirus vaccines and so forth. He claimed it was a political campaign as well, that Australia was teaming up with Washington. This is common critique from China against Australia. And I'll give a couple of quotes here now are important. First, the ambassador said, quote, "The Chinese public is frustrated, dismayed, and disappointed with what Australia is doing now." Quoting again, "I think in the long term, if the mood is going from bad to worse, people would think," and here comes the economic coercion bit, quote, "Why should we go to such a country that is not so friendly to China? The tourists may have second thoughts." Furthermore, he said, "The parents of the students would also think whether this place which they found is not so friendly, even hostile, whether this is the best place to send their kids." And finally, I quote, the ambassador said, "It is up to the people to decide. Maybe the ordinary people will say, why should we drink Australian wine, eat Australian beef?" Right. So these are very clear indications, ambiguous, but also clear. And if you well, let's link this to Germany, since we're being hosted by a German. In 2019, there's a nice example of this. Again, the Huawei case, the Chinese ambassador in Berlin, Wu Qin, threatened there would be consequences, I quote, if Huawei were excluded. And also in that same interview, floated the possibility that German cars would be banned on safety grounds. So what's the link here? The communication link in both instances is threats are grounded in plausible deniability. From, we'll say, from a trade standpoint, from a WTO case law standpoint, they're indicating that there may be issues that are legitimate that can then be applied to German cars on safety issues, or in the Australian case, that it would just be the people's choice to no longer engage in tourism or to cut back on food. And of course, they would enforce maybe the food ban through, and as we see later, claims about dumping and with beef claimed labeling issues. So there's plausible deniability. That's the clear strategy here. You indicate very unambiguously that there will be consequences. You link it to a specific action, but you also phrase it in a way that you can deny later and use more plausible techniques that can stand up in a WTO case law sense.
Thank you very much. I think that's very helpful. And Peter, I would like to know, based on what Nisha just said, can we see that the measures taken are in line with WTO rulings? Remember that the Chinese harbor authorities didn't allow lobsters being processed further and wine delivered. So this is not really a clear communication strategy, I think. This seems to be quite intransparent and awkward. Is this a correct perception?
I would say yes and no. The Chinese government practiced a kind of informal guidance to its state-owned enterprises, to port operators, and to so on. And this is the untransparent bit and very much part of China's playbook. So in the case of coal, they essentially said or instructed, but not in writing, they just were verbal instructions, I guess. They instructed energy companies to stop buying Australian coal. So that's clearly not WTO compliant, but very difficult to track down and bring a case against because it's not written down, it's difficult to investigate and so forth. So I would put that in the category of informal administrative guidance that a single party or state can pursue, but it would be much more difficult for a market economy like Australia to pursue. I can imagine, for instance, if the Australian government directed its private companies, and they are mostly private companies, to stop buying certain Australian goods, they would get the proverbial middle finger, right, and be told to where to get off. So it's a very different system that we're talking about.
What were the effects for Australia? Did it really harm Australia, Peter?
Well, it clearly did. And there were, I would say, some lag effects. So initially, it certainly hurt coal exporters. So coal ships couldn't dock at Chinese ports. They had to find outlets elsewhere. And fairly soon, I would say, they did find those outlets. They were able to switch their export markets to India in particular. So there was a diversion of coal away from China towards the less lucrative Indian market and others. Barley was the single standout success story of diversification, I would say. So the barley market, there's just a few global suppliers. Australia is one of them. It's very high quality barley. It's used in Chinese beer production. And when China stopped buying or instructed its brewing companies to stop buying Australian barley, well, in that case, actually, there was an anti-dumping duty on it, which prevented the trade. They simply switched to Saudi Arabia and Middle Eastern markets. But that didn't happen in all cases. So the lobster industry, for instance, now to think about it from a South Australian, I guess also Nisha, a West Australian point of view, they weren't able to find alternative markets. And those are much more labor-intensive industries. So they were quite severely impacted. The wine industry too. So a mixed story overall, I would say. In terms of the headline numbers, yes, the major commodity players did find alternative export markets, but the more labor-intensive, smaller companies, some of them struggled in certain sectors.
Nisha, is this a general pattern that diversification or trade diversion is taking place after sanctions or coercion measures?
Clearly, there was some success in diversion and reallocation, and that was really taken up in the media that the coercion had largely failed and that basically Australia was a lot more resilient. So there's an issue here with the interpretation of the whole episode, Andreas, that I think is worth touching on. By late 2022, there was a consensus view within the think tank space and even in the kind of general political commentary that Australia had proved resilient to economic coercion. This is despite the fact that there was documented about $20 billion in losses. The Institute for International Trade papers, a couple of papers on this, had actually documented about $60 billion in nominal and $20 billion after diversion and reallocation was taken into account, right? So on the broad scale of the Australian economy, there was a kind of a small impact, right? But what this misses, and Peter alerted a little bit to this, is that there was very concentrated, large subnational losses in South Australia, in Western Australia, rock lobster, wine industry was devastated. And I'll give this as a good example and touch on the political effects then. So the wine industry in 2019, Andreas, wine exports were 1.3 billion to China. But by 2023, these had collapsed to 10 million, right? So this is a 99.2% drop, right? This was after 218% countervailing tariffs were applied. So it wiped out the trade, right? Now, what's even more interesting of this 1.3 billion, 946 million came from a single state, South Australia, right? So, and then thirdly, in terms of diversification, reallocation, this was irreplaceable on the international markets for two reasons. Australian wine had built up a special premium position in the Chinese market, much facilitated by the 2015 bilateral free trade agreement. And they couldn't get that premium internationally. Plus, the international market is heavily saturated with strong competitors. So they just weren't able to get any major international share on that premium wine. So they were wiped out, right? This is a $1 billion trade wiped out. Can you imagine the political pressure that was coming from that industry and from South Australia, from the rock lobster industry in two different states? This played out, right? This became a major political wedge issue in the 2022 federal election. So it was a bit strange that the consensus said that the whole case had been, Australia had been resilient, and yet it became one of the major political issues of the 2022 federal election, with the opposition claiming that it was all the fault of the coalition's poor diplomacy. And there was a lot of subnational pressure, right, from these small and medium-sized enterprises that were under the hammer. And their elected officials were advocating for them clearly. And you could see that pressure playing out. So the interpretation that it was generally resilient, highly resilient, is inaccurate once you look at the subnational level. There was resilience, but you should not underestimate those concentrated subnational costs.
Yeah, I think we are all a bit misled also by Menzor Olson, who in his work emphasized that there are always outside options and it is almost impossible to imply these sanction or coercion policies waterproof. Speaking of outside options, Peter, it is not only about export, it's also about import, particularly when you take a German perspective and think about who are the suppliers of our critical minerals. We see that these are mostly from Chinese sources, either in China or in Africa, owned by Chinese companies. Is it different with respect to sourcing? Is China also applying an export control policy as a coercion tool?
Joyce, just to be clear, are you talking about export controls directed against Australia or against the Europe or globally?
I was rather thinking about a global context here, because I'm not sure whether Australia is really dependent on Chinese critical materials as Europe is dependent on that.
Well, it's the other way around, really. So if one thinks of lithium, for instance, which is a major Australian export to China, which then goes into the production of electric vehicle batteries, which then the European subsequently impose import duties on. You know, we can trace the effects through. But yes, no, China has been playing catch up, I would say, to the United States in particular when it comes to export controls. For instance, they imposed an export control on the TikTok algorithm, which is an interesting one. That was really designed to put a poison pill in place of any potential forced divestiture of TikTok in the United States, inter alia, and forced expropriation of TikTok's intellectual property, which is the algorithm. So that's quite an interesting new age, I would say, export control. But they've also put export controls on a number of critical minerals now. So gallium comes to mind. Always mix this up. It's germanium, Nisha, I think is the one.
Germanium and antimony.
Yeah, and antimony is the third. So they've also got one on germanium. In fact, in germanium's case and gallium, these are rare earth elements, right, which are also critical in various high-tech applications. And China controls currently, anyway, the export market for those particular products. And as we know, in these kinds of critical minerals-related value chains of great interest to Europe, China dominates the processing, not necessarily the extraction of the raw material. So, and that dominance is very high in a number of critical minerals-related value chains, you know, two-thirds of the export they would control typically. So that poses a particular challenge, I would say, for Europe and for European industry, and not just for things like the production of electric vehicles, but well beyond into a range of green transition and future automotive, et cetera, high-value manufacturing applications, including defense, inter alia.
Andres, if I can just jump in as well, just to follow up a couple of points there. So sure. About 60% of mining of minerals and rare earths is done by China, but about 85% of the value-add processing is done by China. And that's quite a sophisticated process. There's a lot of technical know-how required there. In Australia, a lot of firms have joint partnerships or are reliant or have long been reliant on Chinese capital and know-how. The know-how is very important for the processing to learn how to do that. So currently in WS, which is considered the mining capital of the Western world and a big part of US diversification strategy, since 2022, I've calculated, and I may not have captured everything, but about $4.5 billion has been given or promised in letters of interest as funding and also sometimes grants, clear grants without repayment, from the US federal government, various departments, and the Australian federal government. Just to give you an example, one refinery in Yaba in Western Australia has been allotted $1.2 billion. This is for rare earths processing, fully integrated, vertically integrated. $1.2 billion, that's Australian dollars. And as I said, loads of projects are getting funding now. They're trying to vertically integrate or have offtake arrangements from Australia to US processing as well. Lynas has gotten big grants to set up a refinery in Texas. There's big movements underway here between Australia and the United States and big money being underpinning it. And at the same time, within Western Australia, there's a very deep entanglement with Chinese capital, joint ventures, equity ownership. If you think of things like the Inflation Reduction Act, the subsidies, right? Recent rule came, a foreign entity of concern rule, where if you're a lithium supplier and you've got 25% or more Chinese investment and you're an Australian company, your lithium will not be allowed to get an IRA subsidy from 2025. So a lot of firms here even are going to be impacted by US decoupling rules that are moving really fast. So it's a very dynamic domain here at the moment in Western Australia. The state is central to Washington and Canberra's diversification decoupling strategies for critical minerals and for processing.
One final question with respect to Chinese strategies. I also read that they differentiate between the importance of the sectors they are addressing their coercion. They are more harsh to those sectors that are irrelevant to them. The more is at stake, the less they apply coercion. Is that a pattern you can confirm?
Maybe just before we get there, I don't think Australia is in the business of generally decoupling from China. Something will shift or could shift if a different government elected at the next elections. I think there would be a stronger line on China. But a generalized decoupling, no. To use Ursula von der Leyen's phrase, a de-risking of selected sectors underway. And so Australia has always had in place, at least since I can remember, inward investment screening. And so Chinese state-owned enterprises get a much higher level of scrutiny, particularly for investments into critical minerals, rare earth elements, and the like, the sort of mining investments that Nisha was talking about. But for the rest of general trade, let's put it that way, I think there's a much more open policy towards China, and that's important to understand. Anything that has a dual-use potential application, so military and civilian uses, or could be strategic in some sense, that will come under close scrutiny. And so to use Jake Sullivan's phrase when he introduced the US's 2022 national security strategy, he spoke up about the US establishing a high fence around a small yard. So inside the small yard, dual-use technologies, high-tech industries in particular. But what's happening is that yard is widening, and in some cases, the fence is getting higher. If one thinks of electric vehicles effectively being prohibited from accessing the US market, and now Canada following suit as a key US ally, and Australia, I think, increasingly will be expected to do the same in certain segments. So I'm not sure that I answered your question, but I thought it's important to point that out. Maybe Nisha can pick up on your question.
But I still want to insist, is there an asymmetric application of coercion?
Absolutely. I mean, they didn't coerce iron ore, for example, right? So Australia is their key main partner for iron ore. There's no one else. If they cut off Australian iron ore for their steel industry, that'd be great for the world's overcapacity in steel, of course, but it wouldn't be good for Chinese industry and their strategic industrial plans. So they didn't touch iron ore and never made a threat to it because they can't replace that on the global market. There's a fixed amount of iron ore available currently. All it would encourage is a shuffling of supply. They'd take supply from somewhere else at higher cost, and they'd have to get an Australian iron ore would move somewhere else. So it wouldn't make sense. So Andreas, they're careful. They normally target consumer goods often. So wine, beef. They can get different wine and different beef elsewhere, and the party probably doesn't mind if they can't get that at the end of the day, even if they couldn't. It's a luxury as far as they'd be concerned in terms of their strategic plans and geopolitical goals. So they're very careful in what they target. They think carefully. The recent case with the EU situation is the French brandy. I don't think anyone in the Chinese party is going to be too concerned if people can't get their favorite French brandy anytime in the next few months. So again, they've carefully chosen what they're going to target. And so that's always careful consideration. The Chinese take their time, think about what they're going to target. And I think, again, going back to the political pressure points in the Australian case, why did they target a lot of regional agricultural goods? Because the regions are politically very salient and important in Australia's political system. They have an important say. The activities in the regions provide for those communities. And the coalition in particular, which has been a very dominant major party, a big portion of its base is in the regions, the National Party. So, those products that were targeted in regional Australia, that was a very careful strategic choice to apply maximum political pressure internally at low cost to the Chinese economy.
I think there were a couple of exceptions to that argument, Nisha, which I would otherwise agree with. So coal, for example, China suffered an energy crisis that had effectively banned importation of Australian coal. So that had a very real impact on Chinese energy production at the time. Similarly, barley very directly affected Chinese beer producers until they could locate alternative sources. And they're not as high quality sources. So I think the Communist Party is prepared to sacrifice its domestic interests when it wants to make a point, but not in a generalized sense. They knew that in the case of coal, this would inflict pain on Australia, real pain immediately. In the end, it turned out that we found alternative export markets pretty quickly. And the same was true for barley. So that's my response, which I otherwise agree with.
That brings me to my next topic here, lessons for Europe and Germany. When we recall the start of the Russian aggression in Ukraine, Germany banned gas imports from Russia, and this was costly for the German economy. And nevertheless, it was politically maintained. So a question for both of you is, what can we learn as German businesses, German consumers, the German export industry and the European export industry from that kind of coercion? That would be my next topic. And the final one is then directly linking to that. What are the future prospects? But let's start with the lessons for Europe.
Lessons for Europe. So I think there's been a fair bit of study on this now in terms of Australia as a case study. There definitely are market exit opportunities. This can be through finding new markets. Now, That's great because you still sell your product, but often you're selling in multiple markets. You have to build those markets. That's a cost from a business perspective. You have to manage multiple markets because China is a very big market. So if you're replacing that, you've got a lot more work to do. But there was diversification, market exit options for companies that they found that they were able to use. There was also a transformation, Andreas. So products that were being targeted, you could, particularly through formal measures, you could transform them slightly. So it has a different HS code. This was done with things like timber, and you could get them into market. There was also trade deflection that was occurring. So this happened to some extent with lobster. It didn't overcome the lost volumes, but it was lobster started to go through Hong Kong to get into mainland China. And so that was eventually closed down, but that was also a process. So there's some good studies on this that looked at different market strategies that firms could use. But overall, there's still losses and there's still a lot of extra work for the individual businesses. And I think going back to Australia, the fact that the lobster issue has just been resolved very recently, in fact, and the fact that throughout this period, the lobster industry continually lobbied government to get market access back. The wine industry did. Basically, all the industries that were affected continue to lobby and shows that despite the risks and despite the potential for future coercion, businesses will take on board that risk for the market opportunities. So that's what governments in Europe are going to have to face. They'll have to face trying to when they're coerced, their businesses will continue to put pressure on them. There will be opportunities, but there'll still be losses overall because you're replacing many markets for few markets. And so they just need to weigh up what are they trying to achieve. Governments are going to have to increasingly weigh up when they're making specific China policies. They're going to have to calculate that there's a chance of coercion, that this coercion may have a certain amount of cost. You can try and look at historical case studies to estimate costs, potential targets. These will often be indicated when pressure is building in a bilateral relationship. And then if they want to be rational about it, assess, is this specific policy action worth the potential? And I think that's actually why China continues to do coercive actions regularly. There's a long history of this established over the last 20 years. They dial it up and they dial it back. And they continue to maintain leverage over time by doing that. They often set the terms of the conversation, Andreas. There were a couple of political concessions, at least many, some analysts at least, and I agree with them, think there were important concessions in the Australian case. Australia stood its ground. There's no doubt about that. It did not fold. But there were still important concessions made, which should be acknowledged. These include dropping the WTO cases, one against barley tariffs, one against the wine tariffs. Beijing would not want to lose those cases. It would tarnish its image in the global south, staying within the system, and that the West is out to get it and they're the ones breaking the rules. So Beijing would not want to lose those cases. And also, Andreas, there was a particular case where a Chinese firm, Landbridge, got in late 2010 with a 99-year lease in the strategic port of Darwin. And this was under review during the coercion period in the last couple of years. And there was a lot of pressure that this lease should be broken on national security grounds. There's a big marine rotation through Darwin. It's a strategic location. The current Prime Minister, Anthony Albanese, when he was in opposition in 2015, heavily critiqued the 99-year lease, which was given under the coalition, and indicated a willingness to use foreign veto laws to cancel the lease. And then when the review was done, decided not to cancel it in 2022. And this was also seen as a concession to help get the trade relation back. So these are subtle but important. And once again, as I said, the Australian government will have to weigh up future actions against possible coercion. So one way or another, it changes the calculus by using what we view, if you agree, in the rules-based order and separating trade from politics. The Chinese are using an illegal method of punishment and coercion to change the calculus for how other governments behave towards it and change their potential willingness to act against Chinese interests.
Peter, would you recommend a resourcing strategy for critical minerals for Europe? We had a critical mineral coalition in the German industry in the first decade of this century, which then was abandoned. Many people criticize that is naive and not forward-looking. Is that recommendable for a resource-dependent economy to form an internal coalition to strengthen the market power?
I'll answer that question by observing that, in my view, the EU's come a long way already. And in some ways, Germany is lagging behind. That would be my observation. So when it comes to critical minerals, the EU's got a very robust critical minerals strategy. How it executes it is another matter, but at least the strategy is there. And I've done some work on this for the EU, by the way, in the Australia-EU context. So Australia and the EU, for example, have signed a critical minerals partnership and MOU, if you like. Now they have to give effect to it. So basically what the EU has been doing through the Commission is systematically identifying the major critical mineral vulnerabilities that the EU industry as a whole faces, and then which countries are best placed to provide those critical minerals, then forging these critical minerals partnerships with those countries. And then I guess what will flow from that is preferential sourcing arrangements, however those work. So pooling purchasing power somehow to ensure the supply of those critical minerals on European markets. But the EU has moved in other areas. I think of the procurement instrument, for instance, where they've been cracking down on Chinese SOEs accessing European procurement markets. And there have been a few recent cases of that, and that's a pretty interesting instrument. They've also been imposing countervailing duties against third country exports produced by Chinese state-owned enterprises in third countries, and Egypt was the most famous case of that. And the EU has established an anti-coercion instrument as well, which I think it's still in its early days as to how that would work. But where Germany is behind is particularly in relation to its auto industry. So everybody knows that the Chinese subsidize their electric vehicles value chain and the entire value chain. That's not in doubt. What the European Commission has done is to measure the extent of the subsidization leading to the imposition of these duties. And it's the German auto industry that's resisted, amongst others, the imposition of these duties. And essentially what you have is an old industry recognizing that it's no longer competitive, but not wanting to lose its current access to a declining share in the Chinese market, because the Chinese market is changing fundamentally, and therefore seeking to resist change, and the German government going along with that. And I suspect you'll see more and more of that kind of retrograde action, where old European industries are seriously threatened by new and very competitive, and let's be clear about that, Chinese industry.
We come from a long period of stable relations in a rule-based, Western-dominated trading order. Do we have to fear that this tendency of coercion, anti-coercion strategies is increasing?
I can begin there, Andres. I think we're in a bimodal world for the foreseeable future, and that means you're going to have two things going on at once. Think about free trade agreements. There's lots of countries currently still hungry for more free trade agreements. Australia just completed one with the UAE. It's negotiating one with the EU, which we all know is a big challenge. The EU is trying to finalize with Mercosur if the French will only get out of the way. Many countries are looking to continue with a rules-based free trade order. At the same time, the big players who have intense geopolitical issues that we cannot foresee any medium-term resolution are playing a power game. And so what's going to happen is that you're going to have two types of world order working simultaneously. Particularly middle powers and lower are going to have to navigate. Take Australia. Australia is a good example, a clear proponent of a rules-based order since the 1947 GATT, matches with its domestic system, matches with its middle power interests, and it's mainly playing along with that WTO game. But as it supports the US in its strategies in critical minerals, and I would say the US is heading hard decoupling in those sectors, not across its relationship with China, but in EVs, in critical minerals, it's moving towards hard decoupling, it's banning Chinese cars. Australia is supporting that, but it's also not decoupling, as Peter said. It's going to maintain its relationship, but it's going to de-risk and maybe decouple investment just in critical minerals, at least in the medium term, to establish that diversified sector. But it's not going to drive out investment overall, in, even in that sector. It's not unless there's a dramatic change. So Australia is a microcosm for the macrocosm, because nobody's pulled out of the WTO yet. I doubt even Trump is going to do that. I might have to eat that prediction, but I doubt it. Others haven't pulled out. So it continues along. It's not being built up higher necessarily. There's some movements as well with the JSIs, the joint statement initiatives. So that's the complexity, not to jump towards the either or, and how we navigate, how different countries navigate that will depend on their international, their geopolitical interests, their alliances, their partnerships, their susceptibility to coercion, and their clash of interests with China on various issues. For some countries, there's big strategic gains, potentially. India sees itself as being a big winner, potentially, and is starting to win a manufacturing share. So again, there's going to be opportunities for some, there's going to be risks. And I think a rules-based order is a lot of support still at the bilateral level and multilateral level for trade, even as power politics increases.
So maybe just to add to that, Andreas, I think Nisha has pretty much covered the terrain. Look, we don't know what's going to happen in China. There are real pressures building up inside the Chinese system, particularly economic pressures. Would they lead to a potential dislodgement of Xi Jinping? Would Xi Jinping die in office? I mean, you know, who would replace him? Who knows? One thing's for sure, when Xi Jinping came to power, China changed. And so the changes are very much associated with him. He moves it on. Who knows? All bets are off. But then let's look across the Atlantic from a European perspective. And remember that European strategic policy is called open strategic autonomy. The openness refers to maintaining the open rules-based trading system, how imperfect it is. Look at who the main threat to that open rules-based trading system is. Maybe, yes, I'd put China in there for all the reasons we've been discussing. But I'd certainly put the US in there as well, particularly if Donald Trump is elected. Already the US is disrespecting the WTO in a number of ways and actively undermining the system and operating a policy of benign neglect, if nothing else. That could all change under a Trump administration, and they may well pull the US out of the WTO, and then all bets are off, in my view. So we just don't know. We can't predict the future, and certainly not in the long run.
Thank you very much, Peter. Thank you very much, Nisha. That was very interesting. the disappointing part is that we have a very complex world in front of us and we cannot really explain it easily. But this podcast, in my view, added a lot to the explanation. Thank you very much, gentlemen.
Eine Podcast-Reihe der China-Kompetenzplattform Thüringen, gefördert vom BMBF.